Welcome to End of Life University Podcast, where we share real talk about life and death. I'm your host, Dr. Karen Wyatt, retired hospice physician, author, and educator, and I'm glad you're here with me today for episode number 536. In just a moment, I'll be sharing with you a conversation I had with Darnell Lamont Walker. Darnell is an Emmy-nominated children's television writer, but he is also a death doula. And he has written a brand new book called Never Can Say Goodbye, The Life of a Death Doula and the Art of a Peaceful End. And this episode is airing on February 10th, which is actually the day the book is being released to the public. So as of today, if you're listening today and onward, no matter when you're listening, the book's available wherever books are sold, Never Can Say Goodbye, and it's a fantastic book. I think you'll really enjoy our conversation about it. Before we get to that, I just want to thank Jolynn Deloach, who has made a donation to the podcast through PayPal. I really appreciate that. I'm also very grateful to all the people over the past few years who've been supporting my Patreon page and also buying me coffees. I appreciate all of you and how you show up and make contributions that are helping me keep the podcast and the YouTube channel on the air, which is a reminder that I do have a YouTube channel where you can watch the video of Darnell and I talking today, but many, many of the past episodes have videos that are posted on YouTube. So go to End of Life University Podcast on YouTube and you'll be able to watch those if you're a person who enjoys videos. So check that out. And I'll also remind you, I have a Substack account called Soul Code, and you can go there to read some of the blogs that I've been writing. And I also have What Really Matters podcast, Everyday Spirituality, which is just a solo podcast where I share some of the things I'm learning and thinking about these days. So you can check both of those out as well. And we'll move on now with my interview with Darnell Lamont Walker. I'll come back afterwards with a few takeaways and to say goodbye. So here we go. Today, I am so very excited to welcome my special guest, Darnell Lamont Walker. Darnell is a death doula, an Emmy-nominated children's television writer, a producer, and an explorer. Born in Charlottesville, Virginia, he creates spaces worldwide for healing through storytelling, end-of-life care, and workshops on grief, resilience, unlocking the writer within, and radical empathy. He joyfully lives in the Chattahoochee National Forest of North Georgia, which sounds amazing to me. And he's the author of the newly published book coming out today as this episode airs, titled Never Can Say Goodbye, The Life of a Death Doula and the Art of a Peaceful End, published by HarperCollins. And his website is darnellwalker.com. So Darnell, welcome and thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you so much for having me. It's truly an honor. I'm glad to be here.
Oh, I'm so glad we have a chance to discuss your book because it's amazing. I so enjoyed reading it. And so I'm really eager to share it with other people. And I don't always feel that way about every book that I read in this space, but yours is beautifully written and amazing work of storytelling.
Thank you so much. I'm a storyteller at heart. I've always been. And so I'm glad to, you know, as I talk to folks about the book and even, you know, everyone who got an early copy, to know that that came across really, you know, makes me feel I did something right.
Yeah, you're a master at teaching through stories, through the medium of stories, which I think is the most effective way to really move people, to open their hearts. And so, you know, more than any, like, academic or didactic book, a book of stories that all come from your life, all from people that you've sat with at the end of life. It's just phenomenal and so beautifully done.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much. I think like that's part of why I write, and I think that was the best way to do it. I didn't want to write so much of a self-help guy. I just wanted to tell stories of my life and so people could relate. I think everyone can, you know, has done this work. I mentioned it in the book. I think so many people have done this work And I wanted to tell these stories in ways that they could relate to and say, oh, I've done that for someone else. And maybe not the same way, but in a way. And I knew that through storytelling, through these encounters that I've had with the people who allowed me to sit with them and be with them, it would come across that way. And people could say, oh, me too. Me too.
Exactly, because that's what you present in your stories, is that this is a it's a normal everyday human activity in a way to sit with someone as they're dying. And I was in the beginning of the book, I remember you said how often you might be sitting at the bedside of someone who's dying and a family member says, "Oh, I could never do the work you do." And you point out, "But you are. You're doing it
You're
right
doing
now."
that now. Right. And you're doing it now. You're sitting with me doing this thing. And you were doing it before I got here. I'm just here to help you. And so, absolutely.
Yeah, it's in some ways like being with death is so foreign to us still that we don't even recognize that we all may have this kind of innate ability to actually show up and actually be there. We may be more capable of that than any of us even realize.
No, absolutely. I 100% agree. I think we all, we don't call it being a death doula. We just call it love or care. A lot of times, I talk about my grandmother in the book and how she did this work without a title. She did it just because it was what you do for people you love. You help them at the end, or you help them through a loss, or through grief, or through some whatever it is they're battling. And we just call it. We may call it something else, but it is the work.
Yes, and it's really your grandmother. This is, I want you to tell the story a little bit more because it's really because of your grandmother that you're doing this work from what I glean from your book. And the beauty of that, the beauty of what we're able to pass on from generation to generation.
Oh yeah, no, absolutely. My grandmother was amazing. Her name was Irene, Irene Jones. And yeah, like I said, she'd been doing this long before I came along. Her mother had done it before her. It's just what we did for family. But I was a kid and maybe 8 or 9 years old, and she had a sister who was dying of cancer. And I come from a family that doesn't, we don't really want to talk about death. I love talking about it. My grandmother loved talking about it. So we found that comfort in each other. Even at a young age. And so, and I was always with her. She was my favorite person. And so, just watching her do it and watching how she cared for people and watching how the community came to her, like she was my grandmother, but she was also like the mother and grandmother of everyone in the neighborhood. When someone was sick, she'd make potato salad. When, she'd go visit hospitals and I'd go with her. And, when her sister died, it was me and her having these conversations. And then years later, she had a nephew, my cousin, who came home to die. This was at the height of the AIDS epidemic. And families at the time weren't so understanding and so accepting. And so no one wanted to be around, but my grandmother said, you come and stay with me and I'll take care of you. And I was there with her. And so I'm 12 years old, and me and her are taking care of him. And I think that was the first time that I was able to be hands-on at the end of life, which really helped because the following year I went and volunteered at a hospice in town. It was the first year I'd lost a friend. It was my first friend that died anyway. And I was able to, take all the things that I'd learned and not even intentionally. It just came out that way because the school wasn't so supportive in our grief. They were, it was at the time when they were just saying, oh, if you need to talk to someone, the guidance counselor is available. Otherwise, have a good day. And so at recess, I'm talking to my friends saying, hey, maybe we should have a grief circle. The one that didn't call it that, I just said, maybe we should talk about Pam. Maybe we should share stories about Pam. And but all of that came from watching her do the work over years. And not to jump ahead in the book or in this conversation, I don't know if we're going to go there, but years later in 2011, I was able to be there for my grandmother. I was her death doula, and I was the one who was able to the last person to see her alive, and the person who had to give her permission to leave this place.
Such a beautiful full circle in a way with your grandmother. But I think your story just proves to me when adults are willing to talk about death openly and live with it and li live in the midst of it, children have a great capacity to understand death far more than we realize. And we could be training all of our children to be little death doulas in a way, like you were. I mean, we could prepare them so well to be there for their friends, to be there for the rest of the family, and be part of the family as someone is dying. And yet, I think we're still so far away from being able to do that.
Oh, it's sad how far we are from it. And I'm a death doula, but my full-time job is I'm a children's television writer. And so I write for kids. And when I get to do that, and I try to put small things, even if the episode isn't about death, there it could be about transition. It could be about healing through whatever, finding joy, finding ways to honor something that you've lost. Thankfully, about maybe 2 years ago, I put this call out to the studios that I've written for and was working for at the time, saying, "Hey, I'd love to write an episode about death." Had a couple of meetings, but nothing happened. But finally, thankfully, one of the shows that I've written for said yes, and so we get to write about how to honor someone that we loved and lost. Because so Sesame, they got it right. Back when was it Mr. Hooper? Mr. Hooper died. And a fantastic episode. And since then there have been a few, but sometimes it's just a pet. But it's like okay, fine, yes, but. Friends die too, brothers die too, family die too. And if we can help kids get through that, because otherwise they turn into the adults that, I'm helping transition who are so afraid and so afraid of the conversations and so afraid to engage with other people when it's this, this is the thing that we're all going to experience. And so we shouldn't be afraid of it.
And it points out that we will pass on to our children whatever our attitudes and fears are. And so the things we've been too afraid to address or look at in our own lives, we're going to hand that off to our own children who will then have to live with that. And to reverse it all and simply be able to sit down and have honest conversations about real life and what's really happening in our own lives and our families and in the school and for our neighbors. To me, it seems like such a simple fix that could change so many things in our society.
No, absolutely, absolutely. It's the things we pass down, right? Like it's one of those things. And just to give a statistic, there's a fantastic organization, Experience Camps, and they do summer camps for kids who have lost someone close to them, and it's a time for them to come together and be in community and talk about things that we should be talking about, grief, and also just how to move forward and how and reaching back and showing others how they can do the same. But they told me, when I put it out there that I wanted to write for kids, they said, there are about 6 or 7 million kids in the US alone who have experienced death, the death of someone close to them. So why aren't we talking about that? And it's just something that stuck with me. And it's like, I don't, I we have to, I'm trying to break that cycle. So that's my goal.
Yeah. And I do think talking about teaching kids stories, that's absolutely the best way to get through to
Absolutely.
kids, but adults too. But I
Yeah.
think, your story writing is amazing. I see so much potential to move things forward through
Thank
the
you so much.
writing that you do. And
Absolutely.
one thing that you write about that was especially of interest to me and touching to me is death in the Black community. And as someone who I come from hospice, a hospice background where the Black community is underrepresented in our patient population in hospice. And I was thinking back of all the tables I've seen where a group of white people sit around a table and wonder, like, how do we get more people from the Black community to embrace hospice? And I feel like that the fact that they're talking about it is kind of shows us where the problem is, because there is a big gap in how various communities and cultures look at death and dying, and we have to be aware of that if we're going to move the needle forward or make any difference
Oh,
together in
absolutely.
how we all look at death and dying. So I hope you'll talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, absolutely. A large part of that comes from a very fair distrust of the medical system over time. Like I'm from Charlottesville, Virginia, and sadly, there was a study done not long ago. I think 2016 is when I read it. I'm not sure if it was done in 2016, but there was a study done to show that 30% of medical school students at the top 100 hospital didn't believe that Black people felt pain on the level that other patients did, right? So that just goes into this how the system has treated us throughout centuries and while our time here in the US. And so that goes to like how we access medical treatment. And if we want to access medical treatment, like I know so many people who we're not going to the hospital until it's very bad, right? And so and a lot of the work I do, I go in and I find myself having to advocate because sometimes my clients are under-medicated. And if we're at the point of palliative care or even hospice care, it's why aren't you comfortable enough? You're getting Tylenol when you should be getting morphine or things like that. And so and then just also access to the information, because we aren't coming into these hospitals and we aren't coming into these places, we also don't have the same access to the information. And we're not sure who to trust to get the information from, which is why I think it's so important. I know it's so important that we do have Black death doulas to share to share this these messages. And not just Black death, just death doulas in general should know this information to build the trust in the communities. I've been fortunate enough to do that. I work with my clients have crossed many races. But when I go to Black communities and Black families, I know that there's this other step. There's a little more to do because one, we're dealing with grief, but there's also this constant grief that we've been dealing with since we've been here in this country, right? And that doesn't stop. So while we're grieving the loss of our grandma or our friend or mom or whoever, we're also grieving, how the system that, how we've been treated in the system, how we're grieving, the current events that are happening now. Like that goes into that. I always talk about also when, using George Floyd as an example, it was, George Floyd died. And yes, this was a man that we didn't know, but it was all, he also represented our cousin, our uncle, our brother. Like we are very communal people. And so, and community is everything, and we rely on this community. And so when one person dies, whether we knew them or not, it still feels like we still see us in that. And so that's important. So that's what, that's the work that I try to do when I come into these communities and talk to my family and my friends that I know who don't have this information and or why we are doing it the way we're doing it. Like all of that plays a role.
And I think it's just so significant, and remembering that hospice emphasizes moving away from curative treatments toward symptomatic supportive care. But if you try to sell that message to a group of people who've always felt marginalized by the system, who've been denied curative treatments, who haven't been treated fairly by the system, that does not sound appealing. Oh, you're telling me you're taking away the care that I've worked my whole life to try to get care, and now you're taking that away. It doesn't make any sense. And so that message may works well for some groups of people, but not everyone. And I think it's so important that we're sensitive to that and we understand it.
Oh, absolutely. And a large part of that, like I've been fortunate, like I come from documentaries as well. And I remember having a question that I did a documentary about sexual assault, which is and mental health in the Black community, which are two very hard things to talk about. But I was able to get people to come and talk. And one of the questions was, how do you get people to come and just open up and talk to you? And it's like, well, you just have to listen. You don't come in with these assumptions. You don't come in with anything other than a listening ear and you say, I'm here to listen to what you have to say. And you'd be surprised how trust can be built that way. So, well, I wouldn't say you, but so many people are surprised that trust can be built that way. I've been brought into schools of psychology to talk to students about how to build trust in the Black community. And I'm like, has this never been taught? Like, and I'm not a psychologist. I'm not a therapist. I'm not, I'm an advocate. And they thanked me for it. And I was just so surprised that this was new information. But yeah, here we are.
Yeah, here we are. I think you, as a storyteller, you may have this particular capacity for listening because it's listening and hearing the stories of others that inspires, excuse me, inspires the stories that you write. But that's what's so beautiful in your story about the fact that you don't have to have special training to be a listener. You don't have to go to years of school. You learn it. Maybe for you it came naturally to you, but I think we can model for other people just sitting in stillness and quiet and listening and allowing other people the space, a safe space to share their own stories.
No, absolutely. Actually, it didn't come naturally for me, but I thought I was a listener. I've always been a witness, and I've always been someone who observed well. But I wasn't so much a listener until college, and I took an effective listening class. And I actually talked to my professor from college a few months ago, and thanked her because for how much she helped me in this work. Because I went into her course thinking, well, of course I'm going to take this effective listening class because it's an easy A. Everyone's a listener. And I got in there and realized I wasn't listening at all. And it changed how I do everything. I mean, like everything. And I think it doesn't take much. It's just, oh, I can just sit, I hear you now. Like there's a huge difference between I hear you and I see you. And and I'm listening, I'm listening to you, and I now I understand, and I wanted to understand, and even as a storyteller, it's made my story so much more dynamic, my character so much more dynamic, and I'm fully appreciative. But it wasn't always here, and some of us get there through pain. Some of us, become grit listeners through our own pain or through a series of traumatic events sometimes. Unfortunately, but and the same way we reach kindness, right? But we get there hopefully, and it's really the one thing you need in this work. Whether you do it as work or you do it as just someone who wants to be there for a friend, it's just I get that question all the time, like, how can I support my friend who just lost someone? And I say, well, just be there and listen. That's it.
And there's really a shortage, I mean, a crucial shortage of people feeling heard in our society today. I think that's one of our problems is that no one feels like anyone else has the time to listen to them or to hear their story. And so we're each just wandering around in our little bubbles and we're not always connecting deeply. Like that would change everything for us if we were.
100%. I agree. I agree. Undoubtedly. I mean, all the way. It's like it breaks my heart when people say, "Wow," when it's new to them that I'm listening to them, because it's like, but you've been on this planet for a long time, or you've been in this place for a long time. No one has sat and listened, and they're like, "No." And it breaks my heart, and it's so unbelievable, but I know it's true. I know it's true. But we got to get there. We will get there. It's there.
Yeah.
You and I, we exist. And so it'll happen.
I know you wrote in the book that no black man has ever hired you to be a death doula for himself. And that really stood out to me. And then also your extraordinary experience that you had, I think this was using mushrooms when you had a vision of black men lining up just to cry with you. It makes me want to cry right now. That completely broke me open because they'd never been able to cry in their lifetimes while they were alive. And it's so beautifully told in the story, but so devastating, as you were saying, people who've never been heard, never been able to cry or express their pain.
Yeah, I mean, it's generations of men who had to be, who felt they had to be the strong one, you know, who just had put up a wall and said, you know, I'm not going to do this, and never got the opportunity to grieve themselves or to grieve the life that they hoped to have and the life they were losing and the people they were leaving behind. And so it's just, oh, and so it's just, it really breaks my heart. I had a cousin die recently, and you know, as he's dying, he's like, I have to be strong for the family. No, you don't. You know, like everyone could fall apart right now. Everyone, no one has to be strong whatsoever. I tell people all the time, listen, if you want to go crazy right now, everyone would understand. Everyone, my closest, the closest person to me, I wrote about in the book, Dennis, when he lost his girlfriend, Melva. But you know, he lost his girlfriend, and then you know, very soon after his father died. And I remember he called me that morning to tell me his father died, and I just told him, I said, listen, if you just want to lose your mind for a while, there's no one who wouldn't understand that, you know. And I think we have to sometimes give permission to people for, permission to people to do that, and just say, listen, you could fall apart, and I'll be here to help put you back together. I think they need to, that reassurance and that support, you know, like it's, we have to be intentional about that and letting them know that we are there and we're listening again. And but yeah, it's, a large part of what I do is trying to get Black men out of that space. My dad is a person who doesn't want to talk about death ever, and but I find ways to sneak it into the conversations, you know, little by little. And I see, you know, he's come a long way. Now we can have a conversation for about 2 or 3 minutes, where it used to be maybe 10 seconds. So I'm breaking them down slowly. And hopefully, you know, it's like hopefully I'm where I want to be before he dies, or before, if I die first or whatever. But, you know, he's a person who doesn't want to go to the hospital to see people when they're in there. He's a person who doesn't like to address those emotions. And so he's very much one of those folks.
Yeah.
And I'm trying to break us out of that.
And the more fear we have of death, then the more we restrict ourselves from all of the experiences that would actually help us, that would actually show us, oh, it's not as frightening as I think. And it's really hard to overcome that with that
No,
cycle.
absolutely. Absolutely. Like it's not right, like if we could just get over that hump, like, you know, quickly, it's not frightening, and it helps us figure out, okay, where are we? Why do we think this way? And now that I know all these things, I can, maybe I can repair my relationships. Maybe I can, like, there's so much I can do now that I'm willing to face this mortality and face these things. And it helps us be better people for the people we're leaving behind, for ourselves, for everyone.
Yeah, absolutely. You make it so clear that that's really the reason for doing this work, is because we can live a much fuller, better life if we're open and honest about death and dying and not trying to run from it or hide from it.
Yes, no, absolutely. There was a study done years ago. I always bring it up with my friends that if you're reminded of your death 5 times a day, you live a better life. And so I think sometimes we just got to remind those folks. Sometimes we got to sneak it into the conversations, like I do with my dad. Sometimes I send friends texts to say, hey, don't forget you're going to die. And they say, oh, you know what? I should get to eat the dessert first, or I should, you know, whatever that is. But we will be better for it. You know, sometimes love looks like having that conversation, you know.
Yeah, exactly. And I love that you connect those two. Like, being aware of the fact you're going to die doesn't mean you're going to be depressed every day and sit around and mope all day long. No,
Not at
it
all.
means you are more likely to go out and do the one thing you'd enjoy today that you're wondering, is it okay or not if I do this? Yes, do it.
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, I'm one of those lucky people who, when I was 22, and I talk about it in the book, when I was 22, I was diagnosed with a blood clotting disorder. And I had to face my mortality early. You know, it was, at a time when most people think they are invincible, I had doctors telling me, like, oh, you probably should have died a month ago. And then every year I go see my hematologist, who tells me, glad you're still here. You know, let's keep you alive another year. You know, and it's cool. And it never made me sad. I think most of that, thankfully, because my grandma and I was having these conversations early, that death never scared me. Although I do really love this life, and so dying now would be inconvenient, but death never really scared me. And so I took that news and said, oh, well, I shouldn't do these things that will waste my time and that I don't want to do, and I should live this life that will be beautiful and meaningful to me. And it's been an incredible life. I've lived an incredible life, and I still am, and I hope I get to have a long one. But if not, I think by now I've probably have lived the lives of 20 people. You know, and because of that, because I got that news, and I tell people, you know, we could all be so lucky to be diagnosed with something that could kill us at any moment. You know, maybe we make better choices. We, you know, this job that we hate wouldn't matter so much, or whatever that is, whatever that is. You know, I think we have to, but we have to figure it out for ourselves. We have to figure out, if we don't have that, then what? Then we have to be intentional about knowing, you know, reminding ourselves, like, one day this is going to end. And it doesn't have to be every day. It doesn't have to be every week, but when it comes, honor it and say, oh, yeah, so what can I do for myself today? And it doesn't have to be taking the trip to, you know, Vietnam, or jumping off a cliff in Curacao. It could be just, you know, okay, I'll go get that ice cream I've always wanted, or I'll try this thing. It could be something so small, but just honor that thing.
Yeah, and I love that emphasis on remembering the spontaneity of life, because it's these little things, these little moments that end up making life feel so rich and so full. And it really is this backdrop of knowing, okay, I'm mortal, I don't have
Yes.
forever, that helps us, that reminds us constantly, just do those things, just enjoy those things. And even when we encourage people to plan ahead for the end of life and do their advanced directives, I think we're not saying don't be spontaneous, don't plan and try to have a rigid end of life either. Have a
Yeah.
plan, know what you prefer, but then be open to whatever life brings you.
Be open to the changes. Like I've made my first death plan. I was in my 20s, and I think every couple of months I'm like, oh, you know what? No, I think I'll go this way or whatever. And then update people, you know. But also, I am open to everything that comes, and open to the changes, open to knowing that at any moment this could change. And but having those conversations, you know, and letting the people who need to know know, and just showing up and saying, oh, I got this part out of the way. And now I can get to life. You know, this part is done. This advanced directive is done. That took, you know, however, a very short amount of my time compared to, like, all the things that I can do now that this is done. And the time, the hardship that will save the people who are left, you know, for some of us, is immense. You know, it's huge.
Yeah. And I love that you wrote about, I think, is it eight things to keep you from having regrets at the end of life, which
Yeah.
that clearly comes from your experiences of sitting with people and hearing what they do regret, or learning by being able to witness their lives.
Oh, yes, 100%. Like, that's the one of my favorite parts of the book. Mostly because it goes into my belief that, one, just this conversation we're having now, just about facing your mortality, but also, that a death doula is a life doula. And so I'm also here to help you get the life you want. Like, so many people, like, I'm 100% sure I'm going to get to the end with regrets. But I can minimize those, and I can do those things that really matter. I can fix those relationships. I can connect with the people that I love. I can, you know, tell the folks who that I love that I love them so much, and like all of those amazing things. Like if I can get people, other people there, then that's great. You know, it's what I do in the children's television. It's all about that transition and growing. And as long as we still have breath, there's still room to grow. And we're still here. And I think it goes into that for me. Because again, I love this life and I want other people to love it too. And love it, you know, so much that when they get to the end, they are here are all these memories you'll have, here are all these things that you have to hold on to for just if, even if it's this last second, you know, this is the life that you built. And so that goes into that, and I love that so much.
Yeah, I do too. It's really inspiring to think about. And then, along the same lines, you also write about what happens when you're grieving someone that you did not have a good relationship with, that you have a lot of painful memories about, because that's another reality I think a lot of people face, and being unsure how do you show up for a loved one that hurt you or harmed you, and how do you grieve that person after they've died? And that's a really tricky question. So I appreciated that you had stories to share and wrote about that.
No, absolutely. And I love that people can be real about that. And I think we're getting to a point where people, because we're getting to the place, and we've sort of been at a place where people don't say things anymore for the comfort of others. They just want to tell the truth. And that's a big part of what we need to do. We need to tell the truth. And so when someone says, you know, I'm sorry for your loss, you know, you must be hurting. And it's like, no, I actually had a not so great relationship with that person. Or it was complicated, or whatever that is. Or people say, "Oh, how you shouldn't say that about, you know, your dad. You know, he's dead now." Like, yes, but the truth is still the truth, and I get to share that truth. And so, it's very important to write about that. Like, I grew up in a family who said, "Don't speak ill of the dead," and it's like, why not? You know, they knew what they were doing when they were doing it. You know, and as a writer, I always tell. That's one of the questions I get a lot is, or not even a question, but a big fear people have. They say, I want to write, tell this story, but it involves this person in my family, and I'm afraid to do that, or I don't know if I can do that. And I say, well, listen, if they wanted to be written about better, they would have behaved better, right? And so, same thing with death. If they wanted to be remembered better, they would have been better in this life. And so we have to tell the truth for our own sake, for our own healing, for, you know, it hurts to lie, to say, to make other people comfortable and hold our truth in so much. Like that's painful. And we should never have to do that. And so if you have to speak ill, if you have to tell, just be honest. You know, you don't have to say anything, but if they ask, then say it.
And I think if correct me if I get this wrong, but I think there was a story about a woman whose daughter came to visit her as the woman was dying, and the daughter kind of confronted her mother with some honest truths about the mother's failings, and the mother said, "This is why I wanted her to be here," but as if the mother really needed and wanted that opportunity to apologize and to even to look at herself honestly. That was
Absolutely.
powerful.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And even if, and you know, in that story, it was, you know, even if the daughter didn't forgive her, it was more, you know, it was more for the daughter to not have to move through this life with the pain that the mother knew, you know? And she recognized that. I get, you know, she, you know, a great client. And I've had clients who actually had a friend whose mom told, you know, her three children when she was dying, she said, if there's anything you want to ask me or anything you want to know, do it now. And only one of them, you know, did. And the other two now have to walk through this life with these things that cannot be answered by anyone else, you know? And it's like the opportunity was there and they know it, you know, and that's painful. And so, you know, we thankfully some we have to also, you know, we can speak ill of the dead, but as people who are dying or people who have done something done wrong or whatever, give other people the opportunity before we go to, you know, unburden themselves with whatever pain we've caused or and so I hope people read this and see that as well. Like it's not only on the person who's left behind, it's also on us to say, Listen, I'm sorry. Even if you don't forgive me, I want you to move through this world without this weight that I can help take off of you.
Yeah, that's such a good point. And then I keep coming up with all the stories from the book, but there was another, the sweetest thing that you did. You wrote about you're riding on a train, and you observed, you witnessed a woman on the train who got a, I think, a disturbing phone call, and you just, you have such a sense for other people, and you know, tuned in a way. And I thought it was the sweetest thing that you left a little note and put it on her tray table. She went into the restroom when she came back. That it was so touching to me, and also the kindest, sweetest thing to do that asked, didn't require anything of the woman. She could have thrown the note away or ignored it or whatever, but you made yourself available if she needed someone to talk to. And I just thought, what a brilliant thing to do. You didn't have to approach her or, you know, look at her and say, I see you're crying. What's going on? You just left a precious little note. And I think that was such a wonderful way to handle that.
Yeah, thank you so much. I did that because it's been done for me. I remember having a very tough, very hard 11 days of my life. And there was just this woman who walked by me and just said, and I'm sure I was clearly wearing it on my face. And she just touches my shoulder and she says, "It's whatever it is, it's going to be all right." And then she just keeps walking, and I mean, it helped. I'm gonna cry thinking about it, but it changed so much in that moment for me. And so, and I and many times before that, just small things that people have done for me. And so, anytime I'm able to do that for someone, I do it. And I want us all to do it, and especially now that again, wanting to be seen, but also not knowing how to reach out. It's incredibly tough to ask someone for a hug. It's a brave thing to do, and it's hard to ask someone to just sit with you, and especially a stranger when you know no one. Moving around the world and being in spaces has showed me that everyone feels this way. And so if I can do that, you don't, if she said nothing, that's fine. But because she acknowledged it, and we were able to sit and talk, and as she's going to see her dying father at this in this hospital in the place where I'm going, and so I'm just grateful that I'm able to do that for someone, like someone did that for me.
Yeah, it's just such a good reminder. It doesn't take a lot of effort, and it doesn't have to be a huge grand gesture. It could be the tiniest thing. I remember once when I was grieving after my father died, a woman and I were stopped at stop signs opposite each other, and I glanced over at her, and she smiled at me with this most amazing, beautiful smile, and it was as if the light came on, you know, inside my car, and I realized I don't even know who that is. She just smiled at me in a way that touched my heart. It gave me something that I needed in that moment. And I thought, how simple is that? If we all just remember, don't forget to notice people, to smile at them, to connect with them, and even in the look in your eyes, acknowledge, I see you, and I see that you might be in pain right now, and I see you. I'm here too.
Yes, I love that. I love what you said. Don't forget to notice people. That's it. That's it. That's the line. I think so often we just move about, and we know what we need, and we forget to notice that other people need that too. And so if we could just go out and give that small thing, a smile, to help someone, could save a life. I've had people. I'm sure so many of us, have had people. I've had friends who said, actually, I remember one friend specifically who I randomly had a thought about him, hadn't talked to him in months, and I randomly sent him a message because the last time we had spoke was about traveling together somewhere. And I sent him a message and I said, "Hey, do you have your passport yet? I'm still waiting to go into the world." And he's like, no, I'm still getting it. And then I saw him maybe 6 months later at a wedding. And and we hadn't talked from that moment until the wedding. And he says, you know, the day you hit me up, he's like, that was going to be my last day. You know, he's like, I had given up. He's like, but to know that someone still wanted to do something with me in the world, you know, saved my life. And it was like, oh, you know, and then sometimes we don't know. So if at least a smile, at least a smile could help.
Yeah, boy, and especially in the world right now, as we're speaking, there's a lot of pain everywhere, everywhere that we need to be aware of.
Absolutely, absolutely. So I keep telling people we got to find the glimmers, right? Like my dear friend Vaughn told me about this. She's like, every day I look for a glimmer of whatever it is, of happiness, of hope, of joy, because we need that. And so if I can offer that, then great.
Yeah, for me right now, I'm watching the Buddhist monks who are walking for peace from Austin to Washington, D.C., and I follow their progress every day. And then every day, I just think they're out there in this ice storm walking and not asking for anything and just representing peace. Like, wow, okay, I can do something hard too.
Yeah. Yes, that's beautiful. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. We look for those inspirations wherever we can find them.
We can find it as often as we can. I want us all to do that. You know, if people listening now take anything away, I think I really want us to find something every day, you know, to make us smile. It doesn't have to be big. It doesn't, you know, even through we can be in pain and still find that one small thing.
Yeah, so true. Well, Darnell, I wanted to ask you about the title, Never Can Say Goodbye. And can you tell us where that came from?
You know, it didn't come from me, but I fell in love with it as soon as Harper proposed it. I think, like, one, I love the song of every version of the song, Gloria Gaynor, the Jackson 5, everyone, and Isaac Hayes. It's just a thing of, you know, we losing someone and grief and loss. These are the hardest things we would do. And so just that goodbye is it's like, what do you do in that when you know there's no time left? Like, what do you say? What's that final moment? What do you offer? And so when we were, you know, getting to the story and talking about writing it, and this was the title proposal, that's what immediately came in my mind. Like, a lot of times I always think, like, sitting with people who are dying at the end of their life, I think, you know, what's the last thing I want to say to you? You know, when it's time to say goodbye, what's the last thing I want to say to you? And I often think about the last things people have said to me. Some you don't forget those things, you know, and so that never can say goodbye really just hit me, and I fell in love with it right away.
Yeah, I love it too. I wondered, do you ever have any sense of your grandmother watching you and the work you're doing and feeling so
Oh
proud and
yes.
happy in her heart that there's my boy, there's my grandson?
Yeah, absolutely. I see, you know, I find her in so many things. Recently, I was eating grapefruit, and she was the person who introduced me to the fruit, you know, and we would sit there and we would eat that together every morning. And I was eating it, and it just felt and just had a moment. It was a glimmer for the day, and it was like, oh, my grandma. Wow, yes. You know, and it's so I find her in the smallest things and the biggest things often. And so I feel that she is absolutely still watching and looking for ways to communicate every so often.
That's beautiful. I love that. And it inspires me because I'm a grandmother now and I have a 3-year-old granddaughter. We watch all these fairy tales and movies together, and she's already asking questions about death. You know, like, well, why did their parents die? Well, what does that mean? And I feel like as a grandmother, there's some special responsibility there in a way with our grandchildren to say, I want to pass on what I know. I don't want to pass on fear to her. I want to pass on the beauty, the love, the joy, all of those things that I've been able to learn about death to make sure she carries that legacy. And then you're the living proof that that makes a difference, that
That's so.
grandmas change their grandchildren's lives.
Grandmas are global treasures. Grandmas are something. Are always our favorite people. So great job you're doing, and I'm sure she's lucky to have you.
Well, we'll see. We'll see.
You see,
But I'm determined. I'm determined. I'm gonna tell
let's
the stories. I'm gonna have courage. I'm gonna talk about it because, because I also feel like the intimidation of what do you say to a child? How do you talk about death with a child? And is it okay? And is it appropriate? But your story just reinforces, of course it is. Of course it was absolutely the right thing.
do it now. So, at three, so when she turns 7 and 8, it's more just, I know, it's just little touch-ups, and she's
Yeah.
tired of it, but she got it. And so then when she does experience it, it's like, oh, because one day it clicks. One day it's like, oh, like when my grandmother was having these conversations with me, I wasn't sitting around like, oh, this is how I do this when this happens. It was, oh, these things happen, and suddenly I remembered what she said. Suddenly it was, oh, maybe I should take food over to this person. Maybe they're forgetting to eat, or whatever that is. And it kicked in so much later, but it was because she told me so much earlier in life.
Wow. It's so beautiful. Well, I want to just reiterate how wonderful the book is, Never Can Say Goodbye, available February 10th. And what an accomplishment for you to have. How long did it take you to write the book?
I think they gave me 8 months. Thankfully, it's one of those books, and I really had very little plan. It was just like, okay, and I would sit down, and the story, it was like, oh, I remember Melva, I remember Delphine, I remember Larry, and then I just start writing about those experiences that these people allowed me to have with them. And 8 months, I think it took to send in that first draft, and or maybe six, and and then the editing. But it was a fair, like Harper, they're great. My editor Angela, she's amazing. My agent Lane, and so coming together, it was just an amazing team that made it so easy for me that I avoided the nightmares that I've heard other people share about their book writing experience, and so I'm just so lucky and so fortunate for that.
Well, I wanted to say because it's a book of stories, it's very easy to read and it's not frightening. I don't know how to describe it, but it's not confronting in an uncomfortable way about death. It makes it easy to think about and talk about death through the stories of the people that you relate. So I think it's a great gift for everyone to read for themselves, but also a gift to share and I mean a book to gift and share with other people that need to get more comfortable with death and dying because
Oh,
this
yeah.
it's a great read for people who are a little bit uncomfortable and not sure they want to hear about the topic. That's how I see it.
No, that sounds about right. I got a list of people in my head who I'm like, you're gonna get a signed copy, hand delivered, and I want you to read it page from front to back in front of me, so you can get this fear out of your mind, and we can get to the real stuff. Yes, absolutely.
And you've honored so many people by telling their stories, which I think is also a really wonderful way to help ensure someone else's legacy that in their dying has truly been a teaching experience for so many other people now because you've told their story.
Thank you so much. I hope so. I hope I can honor them the way they've, blessed my life. And I'm so fortunate to be able to have these experiences and meet these people and continue to meet amazing people along the way.
Yeah. Well, I'm excited to see what you write next, given that you're still writing children's programming, maybe something for my 3-year-old granddaughter that we can watch together and share and talk
Yeah, there's
about.
great shows for 3-year-olds out there. PBS is always amazing, hands down. So check out the stuff. And yeah, it's some great work out there. And I hope so. I hope I
Yeah.
can continue.
Yeah, me too, definitely. Well, thank you so much, Darnell, for giving me your time, and good luck with Never Can Say Goodbye.
Thank you so much, and I will talk to you again soon, I hope.
All right, take care. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Darnell. I really, truly enjoyed reading his book, and I was particularly happy to learn through the book and through our conversation about death within the Black community, because I still feel like it's such an important issue that those of us outside of that community become more sensitive and more aware of what the issues are. And when we're looking at numbers, like, well, why aren't there more Black people or more people of color in general signing up for hospice? That it dawns on us that hospice is not a welcoming place for many other people. And that's what we need to be working on, is our inclusivity, but also making sure that we're genuinely meeting the needs of people with cultural, ethnic, religious, and social differences. So I think that is a takeaway message for today from Darnell's book, but so many other things. You'll really enjoy reading the book. He's such a fantastic writer. So I encourage you to get Never Can Say Goodbye, The Life of a Death Doula, and The Art of a Peaceful End starting today. It's available anywhere that books are sold. So thanks again for listening in and for sticking with me all the way through to the end. I'll be back in 2 weeks with another interview for you. And until then, remember that we're here for love, which means we're also here for grief, because they go hand in hand. So face your fear, be ready for whatever life brings your way next, and love each and every moment that you have a chance to be here on this beautiful planet. Bye-bye.